Welcome to the Founders Odyssey podcast. The journey of a founder is unlike any other. The chips are seemingly stacked against you as an entrepreneur, but the burning desire to revolutionize the world and leave a lasting impact is stronger now than ever with many founders. Our podcast looks to inspire the next generation of entrepreneurs to pursue their next great idea, educate them on how to make this impossibility a reality, and create a supportive group of entrepreneurs who are there for their fellow founders. Our podcast features only the highest performing entrepreneurs who have bootstrapped, raised funds, built companies, sold companies, and have experienced life-altering challenges and some significant triumphs. Join us on this journey with the Founders Odyssey podcast and listen in on this upcoming episode. Welcome to the Founders Odyssey podcast, where we create an environment for founders to thrive through education, inspiration, and a supportive community. My name is Nathan Bird, and I will be your host today. Today, we welcome special guest James Hammett, serial entrepreneur and founder of a groundbreaking medical technology company called Vistin Labs, working to detect early-stage dementia. Founder of Neurable, a company focused on allowing patients the capability to control their wheelchairs with their minds, and founder of an impactful nonprofit called Lit Conversations, teaching young kids the power of authentic connection and meaningful conversation. Today, we welcome James. Thank you for being on the show today.
A pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Love the energy, and you know, that's what we're going to bring today to the podcast. So tell me a little bit about how you got started in the field of the brain. I think that is such a topic today, right? Where mental health has been something that a lot of people are talking about. But I want to know more about you and how it all began.
Yeah, I mean, thank you. It's definitely an interesting topic. The brain is sort of the final frontier of the body. And for me, it started at a very young age. My parents are both practicing physicians. My dad is an interventional neurologist. And so having pictures of the brain on my kitchen table, you know, x-rays, CTs, that was actually commonplace. It would be the morning, I'd be enjoying a bowl of cereal, and, you know, there would be someone's brain with a tumor in it right next to me. And what was very interesting for me was just understanding that we know so little about the brain. And I had such an overexposure of that, actually, that when I went to college, I decided, you know what, I'm going to study electricity. I'm going to not go into medicine at all. But I always gravitated towards, you know, towards other students who were studying biology, who were studying neuroscience. I mean, this was the language that I grew up with. And I finally met a PhD candidate, Dr. Ramses Alkaid, who I ended up actually starting Neurable with. And he had this idea that the brain, being an electrical organ, could be interpretable. And that sort of broke that barrier for me of inability. I realized that, okay, hold on, maybe there is something that we can do here. Maybe we do know something important about the brain that can be leveraged beyond just, you know, helping someone with a tumor. Yeah, that became a bit of a rabbit hole for me. It's been my career ever since that point in time to speak with other scientists and to learn what we know and do what's possible with the brain.
Isn't that interesting how the different people in our life will push us towards either our career paths or mentors that will help us in specific areas? I find that to be pretty amazing. And, you know, some people don't reach out to mentors. And, you know, who mentors you now, and what are some of the people that you look up to, or who are they?
Wow, that's a great question. I have a rich network of mentors. You know, they're not all, you know, Fortune 500 executives. That's not what I mean. But I have people who teach me so much and who have lived a different walk of life than me. Some of them are my age, some of them are younger than me, some of them are older than me. A very important mentor for me is a person named Louis Mayot. He's a French neuroscientist. As I was beginning to feel comfortable in the space of neuroscience and comfortable developing my own, you know, technology in that space, developing my own insights and publishing papers, Louis Mayo was a powerful influence for me, someone that I could run my ideas by, get some feedback from. Another really important mentor of mine who is and friend is a professor at WPI, Ali Youssefi, a very similar person. You know, I've leaned on him every time that I've needed a second pair of eyes with a background in neuroscience to help me run through some of these ideas and make sure what I'm thinking about is not totally insane. One of the nice things about science is it's such a big world that usually if you have an idea, someone else has thought of it before. And so that's probably the main way that I leverage my advisors. You know, first I ask, well, do you know anyone else who's done this or who's doing this?
And I think this is important actually for other people to learn and also know is during that time, James, that you've had thoughts that other people may have already had, how do you address that without being discouraged? Because that's a good topic, because a lot of entrepreneurs, right, you'll have very good ideas and then you'll look to see if somebody's already created them, and then it's either one, going to inspire you, or two, get you to stop doing what you're doing. How do you address that?
Yeah, that's a good question. I have many other mentors, by the way, as well, but I definitely wanted to explicitly call out those two. And I, through them, right, I've encountered a lot of these scenarios where I've thought of an idea and they tell me, oh yeah, someone else has been there, done that, published, patented, turned it into a business. I've definitely run into that many times. And what I'll tell you is that for me, it's always every single time encouraging to see that somebody else has been there before. Because I'll tell you, no one knows everything. No one has done everything. They may have explored one part of the problem, but if you are investigating it and you have a different life, which we each do, then you have a fundamentally unique perspective on that problem. And so if that person made some discovery, you know, rather than being discouraged by it, I would say leverage it. You know, how does their work serve you with your perspective on that problem? Because I guarantee that they are not thinking of the same customer pain points. I guarantee you that they're not thinking of the same customers. And even if they are, even if it's a total 100% fit, go talk to them. Find out what they're still struggling with, because they might need your help.
That's so good. Never reach an adversity that you can't flip to a positive. And I believe there's more founders out there that really need to hear that right now. They may be going through something that they're distraught with. Some raise money for their business, and there has to be a determination to push through no matter what. So tell me a little bit about...
Wait, if I could share one other thing, just, you know, to reflect on what you just said. My most interesting opportunities have come from speaking with people who, you know, you would consider to be my competitors. I've had an idea, someone else had it first. Those conversations have been the most interesting and fruitful conversations. That's where I've gotten the most business. That's where I've gotten the most opportunity. And so if you see someone who has your idea or something similar, seriously, I cannot recommend it enough to go and actually talk to them.
Yeah, no, that's important. So as far as determination goes and various obstacles, let's go all the way back to when you first started Neurable. You had a partner, and tell us a little bit about how you began that company and maybe one or two obstacles that you faced, but how you overcame.
Thank you. Yeah, that's a really great question. I think that ultimately this is going to be a very unique answer, or maybe not unique, but individual answer. So I don't want anyone to think that they should follow in my same footsteps. But the way that we got started was, you know, I gave this scientist a chance. He was talking about a concept that most would consider controversial at the time, which is that you can correctly know what someone is thinking with brain activity. And I gave him a chance to, you know, present himself. And when he did, I was able to find out what he didn't know. And I was able to realize that actually that's where I could help. That's where I could contribute. So what we did is we joined a hackathon together and we tried combining our ideas. We put it into action. We didn't win the hackathon. We didn't win any prizes there, but we were able to create a animated character that you could control with your mind. And it was, you know, amazing. It was incredible. It was actually so futuristic that I wonder if people actually could understand that we had really created that just on the spot in that day. I think a lot of people who saw our booth maybe thought we'd put weeks or months into it. And so that's really how we started the business, because we created an incredible demo that investors saw. And maybe that was the reward that we ultimately were after without even knowing it, because the investors put money into the company when they saw how powerful that was, how well it worked. And so that's sort of how we created our company. But, there were so many obstacles. One obstacle that I'll share is that, you know, even though we had an early win like that, it took us 6 months, maybe even a little longer, before we were able to create a demo that was outside of animation, you know, to actually control a toy car, for example. That was a demo that we needed for our investors. That took us a whole lot longer, because it turns out that, you know, it wasn't as simple as just having the car go, you know, left or right. We needed to have precision controls. The investors wanted to see us navigate a course with that toy car, you know, like what happens if I have a wheelchair next to a staircase? How do I make sure that the wheelchair doesn't go down the staircase? So that was a very big technical challenge. And the way that we overcame that was just with perseverance. Honestly, it's perseverance, because I went through so many advisors, scientists, trying to understand, you know, what we could do differently. And it was really a case of going down the list of trying every single idea until something worked. And it was at that 6 month that we were at that point on the list. I think it was idea number 120 that we finally figured it out. And so that was really amazing. And another obstacle was, you know, how to relocate our company to a ecosystem that could support us a little bit better, which would be Boston. We started our company in Michigan originally. And that obstacle we were able to overcome with teamwork. One of the biggest challenges to moving your company is, you know, what do you do with your people? Can everybody move? And we were very fortunate. We were a team of about 5 people, and we were able to, you know, get everybody on board with the move. Help each other with packing up our things, help each other with loading up the truck, and, you know, making sure everybody was going into this journey happy and heard, and understood and excited. And we were able to do that, I think, through our team building exercises. We would be making dinner as a group, you know, at least one night a week, every week. And this was before the move. So we already had that really strong sense of family in our company culture. And I think that that's what allowed us to relocate our company and keep everybody on board and really turn it into a win. You know, we were all excited to launch our business in Boston, and you know, no one had any homesickness or no one dragged their feet. No one moved back to Michigan.
So talk more about company culture and how you created that and how intentional you were about doing that. That sounds like it not only helped you through the adversity that you guys were facing or different changes that you had to make, but also it created a solid foundation for the future. Could you touch on that a little bit more?
Yeah, I definitely can. Company culture is the most important thing that a company can have. And the reason that I say that is because, you know, not every dollar is equal. You know, especially in a situation where you have people with salaries and you have consultants, people external to the company who interact with you, your culture affects every aspect of the business. It really is the source of momentum, is what I would say. And so if you have a really strong company culture, what that translates into is it translates into incredibly efficient employees, incredibly efficient consultants, people outside of the company. And it also translates into improved creative ability of people. You know, you're going to have people who go above and beyond whatever the job description was, whatever the vision you had. People will contribute directly to your vision of the company. And most importantly, because all of that is, you know, plus, but But most importantly, culture saves your company, because every now and then we get hit with some type of disaster, some type of earthquake that threatens the foundation. And, you know, when you're talking about just money, or when you're talking about, you know, other tangible things that are traditional metrics of success for a business, you know, that stuff can be very temporary. And if it's gone, you'd be amazed to see how quickly, you know, someone can change teams. Someone can leave with some critical IP. You can have some real disasters that happen. And I think that culture is ultimately your stopgap for all of those things. Culture will save your company when you know there's risk of not being able to send out a paycheck, when the results aren't working in your favor, or sales are taking a little too long. You know, the cycles are longer than you expected. Ultimately, I think culture is such a boon. You know, it saves your company from certain death, and it allows your company to be incredibly more valuable than you could ever imagine. So I put an enormous amount of my attention into building the right company culture every single time.
Yeah, that's really insightful. Thank you for sharing. I know I've experienced that as well. I mean, you can be the smartest programmer on the planet, but if you can't get along with each other, or there's an internal cancer within the organization, then there's a major problem and you can't move forward at the pace and the momentum that you would like to. And in addition to that, it's about the attraction for people to come work for you or with you on this mission that you've created. And, you know, you sound like a very mission-oriented person. Can you share with us a little bit about this nonprofit that we spoke of when we first introduced you, Lit Conversations?
Yeah, certainly. So when the pandemic started, you know, I didn't want to think about how it was affecting me. And, you know, I think for a lot of people, it highlighted loneliness. Definitely for me, it made me feel particularly lonely. But I'm always trying to turn negatives into positives. And one of the ways that I interpreted that reality was, okay, this is an opportunity. Who could I help? Who could maybe be feeling lonely right now also? Because how do you solve loneliness? You get people together. And I realized that probably the people who felt the most lonely during the pandemic are students. I attribute a lot of my social mannerisms and success to my classroom engagements, you know, my friends there. And I can't even imagine what it's like to go to middle school or high school and suddenly be totally cut off from your friends, and, you know, limited to just your family as a kid, you know, not having any financial freedom or anything like that. So I started calling up some schools and figuring out, you know, what is it that I can do to help? And I was naive at the beginning. I wanted to just give them money. They don't want money. What they want is they want people to talk to the kids. And so that's Lit Conversations. What we do is we share our time. We're young professionals who share our time with classrooms of students between the ages of 13 and 18. And we've done a great program so far. We have over 200 volunteers. We've served almost 1,000 students at this point. And yeah, Nathan, thank you for asking about it, because it's definitely something that makes life worth meaning for me.
Yeah, I think that's extremely important. I mean, yesterday I read something on LinkedIn, somebody posted, and they, you know, they were building a company, they had 400% growth. He was just pushing the company so fast, and there was an internal struggle. He was ousted illegally, but then he started to look at more legacy and impact and what he was doing for the world. And he's in a really good place right now, because he was able to take a step back from the hustle and bustle and realize what was truly most important, was, you know, the relationships that he's created, the legacy that he's leaving with his young kids, and, you know, how he's building that. And I think that's extremely important in what you're doing here, and also what you're sparking in others to do, right? So tell me a little bit more about what your vision is for that and how it could potentially expand.
Yeah, thank you. So when I was in, I could tell another story. I believe that the way that I grew up influenced who I became today. And part of that was that I had that opportunity that I'm giving to kids with Lit. I would meet a lot of young adults while I was a teenager because I would take the train to go to school. And that gave me so much exposure to different careers. And that's ultimately what I want to give to these students through Lit Conversations. I want to create the next wave of game-changing adults, you know? I want to create other students, other humans like me who can see that a lot of their beliefs maybe don't hold up when tested in reality. You know, I think that there are a lot of really great ideas, for example, that don't get off the ground because the founder doesn't believe enough in them. And that's why psychology is so interesting to me, especially contributing positively to psychology for the next generation. I think that ultimately what we're able to do with Lit Conversations is create a wave of humans who are highly successful, contributing positively to society and to the environment, and who are more creative than I will ever be, because they're getting extra attention on this subject in particular. You know,
there's no success without succession. You know what I mean?
Exactly. Yes. Yes.
And if you're focused in on that, if you're focused in on that next generation, man, that's super important. I'm thinking you should call it the Lit Bus, and then you can drive kids around for a little while and have intentional conversations on a bus. That might be a good idea. Well, man, I'm excited to get into Vistem Labs. I mean, that's going to be just super exciting here. You're working with early stage dementia, which we believe it could possibly be reversed. But you'll have to share with me a little bit about how that journey has gone and where you see it going.
Thank you. Yeah, so I started a company called Vistem Labs, where our goal is to be the first test that's used by your doctor's office when you have a cognitive complaint. You know, you think that you're not able to remember things well, or someone in your family tells you that you're acting strange. We want to be the first tool to find out if there's a problem. And the way that journey is going is so far so good. We've done two independent clinical studies, one in the US, one in Germany. We validated our technology through that effort. And we've also been able to create some traction with pharma companies. But what I'll share is, you know, there's always some bad with the good in a way. Some challenge to the opportunity. And the challenge for us is the financial risk. We've had such an incredible challenge for raising funds during this time. A lot of investors at the moment are hyper-focused on therapeutics. You know, they want to see the next blockbuster drug. They want to see the pill business model where it's easy. You know, someone pays and they have an outcome and that's it. But we know fundamentally at Vistem Labs that until we have better diagnostics, none of those miracle drugs will ever actually work, because people at the moment get turned away from their physician when they have a cognitive disorder. And it's usually after being turned away over 20 years that they finally get their diagnosis, or they suddenly become paralyzed or something dramatic happens to them where they finally get their diagnosis. So we're trying to change that model. We believe that any drug really can be one of those miracle drugs, as long as the timing is right and the patient is correctly diagnosed. So that's currently our goal. And we're raising funds to make that happen. We're building out a team. And like it goes back to your early question of company culture. Company culture doesn't just come from the person who started the company. It comes from the people that you hire and bring into it. And at the moment, growing my team is one of the best ways that I can foster that company culture and create some of that value that I was talking about earlier.
Seems to be just a great industry, though, in the mind, right? But also, can you share with us a little bit more about actual dementia and some of the research that you have done on the space to really uncover your desire to go and make an impact in the space?
Yeah, that's a good question too. So let's see. There's a lot of controversy. Dementia is not well understood. At the moment, we really just assign these umbrella terms. you know, Alzheimer's, for example, is showing to be to affect people in very different ways. It might not be one disease, it might be multiple diseases. And there's a growing body of evidence that would suggest that at least one variation of this, potentially all of them, but at least one, is a form of diabetes. It's still controversial. There aren't, you know, it's not well established. There aren't doctors all over the world who will agree with me. But there is growing peer-reviewed clinical evidence that Alzheimer's is very closely tied to diabetes, and that metabolic changes, you know, changes in a person's diet, sleep, exercise, similar to what you would give to someone who is a diabetic, have effects on cognitive ability. And it's really no surprise. I mean, in sports science, it's well understood that physical activity increases cognitive ability. Across the board, it's a significant effect. And now we're finally seeing evidence that there may be a diabetic reason for this, that maybe people who don't exercise actually have their brains suffer some deficits as a result of that lack of exercise. So it's a very promising field right now, because it's very challenging to measure cognition. We have all sorts of tools. And we also know that there are many therapies that are successful, but the therapies are only effective when used early. And so I'm really excited to be playing in this field, because I believe we can detect it early. I believe that, you know, all these other companies that exist can be partners of ours that we can work with, and that we can develop cures together. And I also believe that the next wave of therapies are not limited to pharmaceuticals, that there are nutraceuticals coming out, and there's also greater interest in behavioral aspects of healing people and digital therapeutics. There's another company that I find very interesting as well, called Elamind, where they're helping people with insomnia fall asleep faster. And they're doing this with a combination of tracking the person's brain activity and, you know, applying stimulation that is tuned to that person's brain activity. And it's really incredible stuff. I love to be in this field.
As an entrepreneur, we're always trying to optimize our performance with our minds. Is there any way that we can do that you know, that you have experienced or that you have researched? Is it through nootropics? Is it through brain exercises? Is it through, you know, could you explain?
Yeah, that's a good question. It's a difficult one to answer, because anyone that you ask will give a different answer. Subjective experiences are inherently subjective. And also it depends on what it means. What is your goal? You know, I've learned a bit about nootropics because it's in my space. And what I've learned is that most nootropics have a positive effect and some type of side effect as well. For example, I know that there are some nootropics that will make people very creative and do well at work, but they also seem to flatten their personality. So there are always these trade-offs to be mindful of. What I would suggest to someone who wants to optimize their performance is to experiment, you know, really sit with yourself and study yourself and see how these different things affect you. One of the tools that has really been helpful to me is meditation. I don't use it to calm my mind. I'm not a very stressed individual. What I use it instead is to increase my ability to sense myself. The activity of sitting still and focusing only on yourself is a great opportunity to build neurons that can focus on your body, to build neurons throughout your body, so that you can increase your tactile perception. Can you increase your ability to feel the air on your skin? It's not just psychological. You are actually increasing your ability to sense these things. And the reason I bring that up is because then when I do try some of these other experiences, my ability to judge them and to evaluate them is enhanced. So I would say that is a very important piece of the puzzle, meditation. But then the last answer that I would like to share is, in terms of improving your ability, it's really just talk to people and connect with people. I think that there's no better way to be challenging your mind and growing your mind than learning from others. And if you read books by Stephen Kotler or anyone else who has studied flow state, for example, which is peak performance, it's studied in Navy SEALs, for example. The U.S. government actively, you know, believes in flow state and uses it for military purposes for improving performance for those people. Flow state is something worth reading about. And you might be surprised to learn that it's enhanced when practiced with others. So having a conversation with someone, especially one that excites you, will put you into flow state and will make you hyper-performant. And that's one of the reasons that getting a coffee with a friend before you go to work, for example, can sometimes have a huge effect on your day.
I know we've had coffee together and we certainly were in flow state and it was hyper-focused. A lot of great ideas. So question about neural pathways and being able to recreate or create new neural pathways through flow state and through meditation. Have you done any research with that? It sounds like you've experienced it through your own, but do you have any substantial research on that that people could learn about?
I don't have any of my own research, but there's plenty of research that I can point to. Stephen Kotler is a really great person worth reading about. He has a book called The Rise of Superman that has changed my life. It talks about how high-performing athletes, and I believe soldiers are even mentioned in there. I think that's where I first heard it, use flow state to improve their performance. And what I can share about from my own knowledge about flow state, and that way, you know, you're not just hearing me say a term and then wondering, okay, well, what is that? Most of the neurons in your brain are dedicated to subconscious activities. You know, the part of your brain responsible for your conscious behaviors is very small. It may be controlling, right? Like you may be able to tell yourself to do one thing versus another. But what I've also learned is that we're incredibly emotional beings and that our concept of free will is not well established. It's very possible that we're just driven by our subconscious behaviors and that our conscious minds are only, you know, creating rationale that explains some of our decisions. So what I learned from that basically is that flow state is when you have optimized your subconscious to be able to accomplish difficult things without your conscious mind's need to intervene. For example, I was learning the piano. At the very beginning of learning piano, I had to focus on each individual finger. Okay, this one is going to touch that key and that note means that thing. But once my subconscious is sufficiently trained, I can almost play piano with my eyes closed. I don't even have to think about it. The fingers know what they're doing. That is flow. And so flow is when you actually don't have to think, your body just does. And for certain activities like wingsuit jumps off of a cliff, you literally have to be in flow because your conscious mind does not process data as quickly as your subconscious mind. You just don't have enough neurons for it. Your parallel processing isn't there. So you risk dying using your conscious mind in those types of scenarios. Same things with the soldiers. So that's what flow state really is about. It's about having your subconscious mind as activated as possible and serving you as much as possible. And one of the ways that I hypothesize that flow state works when we're talking about a group setting is that just, you know, evolutionarily speaking, humans are social creatures. So a lot of our social behaviors, a lot of our social mannerisms are inherently subconscious. And 70% of communication is body language. You know, somebody who says yes, but with a different body language than someone who says yes with, you know, I guess also a different body language can tell you two totally different things, right? You can pick up on things like fear and excitement. When we talk about things like consent, which is also a very important topic, body language plays a role in that too. I think that sometimes we pay attention to, you know, the words of what people are saying, but I think that body language deserves its own recognition in consent. And anyway, those are just some of my realizations. In terms of my, you know, direct experience, just reading studies, the subconscious mind is much more powerful than the conscious mind. So be aware of that. And then the second is for people who have their emotional centers in the amygdala damaged, those people are not able to make conscious decisions. They're not able to pick whether to put their left sock on or their right sock first. And as a result, they put on no socks and they live in 24/7, you know, care facilities. So that's one reason why I suspect that we're mostly emotional creatures rather than, you know, conscious creatures. But yeah, I think that's a long answer, but that's a good one for your question.
No, that's perfect. I mean, we're just trying to enlighten people right now. This is the Mind Podcast. This is a wonderful conversation in regards to the depth of really the mind and how it plays such an important role in not only your business, but in your relationships and how you actually continue to go on in your life. So could you share with us a little bit about how to enter into flow state? I think that's super important. And we understand as well, in order to enter into flow state, we must be very focused. And there's a lot of distractions out there right now. So as far as, you know, you said you enter into by meditation. Is there any other ways that you know of that you could suggest that we do?
Yeah, that's a good question.
Stephen Kotler.
Well, no, I'm not just going to say read a book. I mean, in the book, he talks about flow state, and I tend to agree with this. You know, you need to challenge yourself to the point where it's not possible to just use your conscious mind. That's why I use the piano as a good example, because, you know, if you're using your conscious mind, you just simply can't play the piano. There's too much happening in parallel. You have to do things too quickly in sequence. So what I would suggest is, you know, go outside, try to do a sport. There's a reason that people who are successful entrepreneurs are also usually physically active and they have some type of sport that they play. You know, that will put them into flow state. Another thing that I recommend is, yeah, I mean, talk to your friends, get into some interesting philosophical conversations. As long as it sparks your curiosity, that can be another way. And if you also aren't, you know, able to go outside, or if you're not athletic, you know, art is another really great way to get to flow state. If you can lose yourself in a cooking activity or in a painting activity. The reason that I mentioned meditation is because it builds your awareness. You'll more easily be able to tell which of these activities puts you into flow state fastest and the most effectively, based on how you feel. But those activities also are pretty proven to put you into that state. You know, the art, because it's so difficult to balance what you see in your head, you know, your perfectionist mind and what is real in front of you. That's a very difficult thing to balance. And then when you're playing those high activity sports, you know, you just have to be in flow state in order to compete. I mean, flow state really, you know, the reason I brought up evolution before is that it's necessary. It's an evolutionary advantage to have this ability to drop into your subconscious. We all have it because it's all been given to us as a result of you know, the competitive nature of life. And, you know, one of the things that Stephen Kotler talks about is you know, life or death scenarios. If you're in a life or death scenario, that's really where your flow state is activated the most. You know, you have adrenaline pumping through you. And there are many stories of people who say that, you know, that their mind went blank and they don't even remember what happened, but they pulled off some crazy feat and survived. One of my favorite examples is not quite as scary, but it's about a surfer who made it to the very top of this basically 200-foot wave, and he went a little too high. He went to the point where the wave was going to crash, and he was going to be the first thing basically to smash into the water below. And he did something that no other surfer in history had ever done. And he did it subconsciously. He didn't even think about it, and it saved his life. And you know, the moment that he realized he was in that danger zone, you know, he sort of just like became this subconscious creature. He didn't know what he was doing, but he pulled it off. It's really cool because it's a technique that's now used consciously by a lot of surfers. He just put his hands in the water next to his board and his foot as well, and it dragged him down. He like brought himself deeper into the wave and yeah, I mean, saved his life. And that was just a result of flow state. You know, he was interviewed after that event. Why did he do that? No one had ever done that before. No one thought of it. no one thought that it would work. You know, sometimes putting more of yourself into the water makes it easier for you to be picked up, right? But he just doesn't know. It just happened, and it was a result of flow.
And that's great, man. I'm still trying to figure out how to subconsciously fly. Can you help me with that?
Possibly.
Levitation, you know,
if it's possible.
Well, yeah. Man, I'm excited for the future here for you, for the growth of Vistam Labs, and, you know, really just doing some good work with people and helping to change and transform the lives of people. I think that's what I've gotten from you and the many months that we've known each other, and just understanding your vigor and the drive that you have to make this all possible. You know, the culture that you're creating, the excitement and exuberance that you share with others in regards to what it is you do. I do believe that every entrepreneur out there needs that excitement. And I'd be curious, actually, and this would be for everybody out there as well, maybe glean some wisdom here from James on how you maintain that excitement in the midst of adversity.
Wait, is this a question?
Yeah, yeah. How do you maintain your excitement in the midst of, you know, various obstacles that you may face?
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely a question that's difficult to answer. I sort of thought it was rhetorical. I would say that psychology is your best friend. You know, if you can recognize that your body is mostly subconscious, then you can recognize that your ability to stay excited is what causes you to be excited in the first place. So, you know, you can train your body to respond to adversity how you want it to respond. You know, you hear a lot, for example, about people who do manifestations, right? You hear about people who write their goals and their goals come true. There is some actual science to that. And the actual science is that, you know, those things are now premeditated. If I'm walking down the street and suddenly someone comes out with a knife and threatens me for my wallet, right? I'm going to be in shock. It's a scenario that I didn't expect. And as a result, I'm going to do whatever, you know, whatever my impulses lead me to do, which most likely will not be, you know, well thought out, most likely won't be to my benefit, and most likely will have, you know, me not feeling calm and feeling stressed out, and, you know, feeling sad afterwards, right? But if instead I, for example, took a martial arts class and I thought about, okay, well, this is what happens if somebody were to threaten me with a knife, you know, Since I don't want people to be vigilantes, and also this is well understood, the right move when you get threatened is to take your wallet out of your pocket, throw it, and run in the opposite direction, right? The throw distracts the person, and then, you know, you're safe. So, you know, just like being able to anticipate those scenarios means that when that scenario is in my life, I feel calm. Okay, I know what to do here. I already know the decision that I want to make. So I don't have to feel stressed. I also don't have to feel like I made a bad decision because I know that this was out of my control. This is just the result of the environment putting something in front of me. And the decision that I'm making is the one that I've thought about, the one that makes the most sense. And then I can leave that experience and I can leave knowing that, okay, you know, I'm really grateful that I took the time to anticipate that scenario, and that I was able to create the best outcome. So I would say that, you know, someone would say maybe preparation is key, but you don't necessarily have to be as prepared as that. Just thinking about the scenario before you encounter it gives you that preparation that you need. And that preparation has a technical term called priming. And in fact, with athletes, if you have someone imagine lifting a weight and then pick it up, they can lift more weight when they imagine it first. Okay? That is the power of your psychology, because your subconscious mind is ready. There is nothing more inefficient than a mind that has to gather all the details at once in order to make a good decision. If you already have it in your mind, if you already know how you're going to react, you're going to feel good. And so that's how I stay optimistic, because every time that I encounter an obstacle, I know that it's an obstacle that if I haven't encountered before, then I'm going to encounter it again. And I'm going to use this knowledge to make a better choice next time. And fortunately, you know, at least in the world of business, these aren't life and death scenarios. I can fail. I can make mistakes. And I get to try again and again and again and again. And that is the brilliant part of it, because every single time that you try, you will do better the next time. And one time you will, you know, hit that ball out of the park. It's going to be a home run. And that's what we play this game for. To win.
Incredible. Incredible. Hope everybody out there is just enjoying this podcast, because I know I am.
Well, all you have to do is not give up on yourself, because you will fail, and you will fail more times than you can expect. But perseverance is the answer, because your mind is so freaking plastic. If you didn't have the ability to win, you would not be here today. And that's the truth. You have this hardwired into your body. The people who don't win, the people who fail, are the people who let anxiety get the best of them.
Yeah, no, that's so good.
That is a fact.
Well, everybody out there, I hope you, like, once again, enjoy this podcast. And James, how do we get a hold of you, and how can we support you on your journey?
Thank you. Yeah, well, so I'm currently heavily focused on Vistam Labs. You know, please look us up. The best way to reach out to me would be to, you know, find me on LinkedIn or email me directly. It's just my first and last name at Gmail. So jameshammett@gmail.com. The best way to support me would be to reach out and say hi. You know, if you have any thoughts about, you know, what we're working on, if you'd like to test some of our technology and help us improve what we're building and learn more with you as a participant, then that's something that I actively encourage. If there are people in the audience who are connected with anyone who's fundraising or who's connected in the medical space, maybe pharmaceuticals, we would certainly appreciate connecting with you as well, because we can solve some of these problems together.
All right. Well, guys, if you like today's episode, feel free to subscribe. We've got a great YouTube channel building, and we've had some amazing interviews with people that have raised millions in funding, that have taken their company IPO, and awesome founders just like James here. So once again, thank you, and we'll see you next time.